What's going on, travel family? Shout out to all the adventurers near and far. Welcome to Point Noir, home of the Point Noir podcast, where we equip men of color to shift their paradigms through travel. As always, I'm your audio tour guide, your humble host, Jerry the Third, aka the one and only Kimono Jack, and I'd like to welcome you here to the 80th session of the Point Noir podcast. We're at 80, y'all. We keep climbing even with the bi-weekly schedule. Hope you all are adjusting to that change. The downloads and the listens have been awesome. The only thing we're missing right now is some reviews. Check in with your boy. Let me know what you think about the show. If you haven't left us a review on iTunes, please, please, please spare just a few minutes and do that for us. It's such a huge favor. We'd really appreciate it. Outside of that, hopefully everybody is feeling good, staying well, taking care of that gray matter in between their ears. Make sure y'all getting rest, meditating, journaling, taking care of your mental wealth, because really at the end of the day, that's all we got. So make sure you're doing things for you, taking time off, taking some naps, even if you work from home, like, yo, take those naps, get them in. I'm super excited to introduce today's special guest, and I don't think we have any other updates. So you know what? Without further ado, let's introduce today's special guest. Joining us today as our most distinguished guest at the point is Mr. Guthrie Ramsey, or as I refer to him, Mr. Ramsey. Make sure you check him out on Instagram at Ramsey Music, and to see all of his upcoming projects and all of his past amazing projects, make sure you visit musicology.com. That will be spelled out in the show details. Not only is Mr. Ramsey an accomplished musician, a distinguished educator, and a published historian, he is also a world traveler. Go figure. He does it all, and this is hands down one of my favorite conversations that we've ever produced on the show. I'll keep it really, really short and let him do all the speaking for himself. But it's one thing to encounter somebody who knows how to talk the talk. A lot of us do. A lot of the men on the show know how to talk the talk. They are living their truth, and I love it. But Mr. Ramsey also brings the experience set of walking the walk, and it just sounds different when you've heard somebody who has gone through it and they're sharing their actual experiences, the pitfalls, the highs, the lows over time. That's how I judge success, is what does success look like over time? Sometimes it's easy to pop for a couple minutes or to go through your ordeal for a couple years, but to be consistent for decades over time, that's something and a story worth listening to from my perspective. So thanks again so much, Mr. Ramsey, for spending the time. And y'all, get ready for our normal three-step dance, because we're about to get into some stuff. Step number one, pour yourself a refreshing beverage of choice. Step number two, find the comfiest corner on the coziest couch that you can. Step three, take a deep breath, exhale, and get ready to enjoy another awesome session from us here at the Point Noir Podcast. I'll see you on the flip side. Hey, what's going on, Mr. Ramsey? How you doing? Thanks so much for joining me today at The Point. It's a pleasure to have you here.
Thanks very much, Jerry 3, or J3, as I affectionately call you.
And I appreciate that. You will probably be the only guest I ever address as Mr. Anything, and that's because of our relationship, but I have a ton of respect for you. You're a close and dear friend of the family, and I'm excited that you wanted to be on my, you know, my little podcast, my little endeavor here.
Much respect. You know, we have been on the same recording. I guess we're moving it up.
Growing levels and levels. And speaking of recording, not only are you a musician, a creator, a producer, an educator, a podcaster yourself, an author, you do so many things. So before we get into the travel part of our conversation, I'd love for you to introduce yourself to the audience. I'd really appreciate it.
Sure. My name is Guthrie Ramsey. I'm a professor of music history at the University of Pennsylvania, where I've been teaching for 21 years. Prior to that, I was at Tufts University outside of Boston for 4 years. And I've been playing piano since childhood and working on songs, you know, since I was a teenager, I guess. And I began playing jazz in my teen years and just branched out from there, gospel, toured with a rock band earlier in life, and decided to leave the road and go to college I guess, about the time that a lot of people are graduating college. And then, you know, kept playing music. And I was a school teacher, a music specialist for 3 years after college. And then I stopped all that to study music history. And from there, you know, I kept teaching and kept making music.
Appreciate that. And you have a longer resume than a lot of our guests. So thanks for sharing, because it's important to know who you're talking to, the sort of personalities and things like that. And that was some knowledge for me as well. But one of the things that you mentioned that I knew about, but I really want to ask you about, is your knowledge of music history and travel. Because as a musician, we've both traveled the world playing music, and you find that the music kind of preceded us in a lot of ways. Like, jazz musicians have been in Paris, literally changing the culture. And then I step on the scene in the, you know, 2010s, and people still have that impression that, oh man, Black American musician, this is going to be some dope stuff.
Well, I think you probably have had more experience traveling and playing music than I have, because a lot of my international travel, I think, has been connected to being a professor first. And then, you know, I always drag the performers along with me. You know, I was, you know, they think they're booking a professor and I bring a band.
Right. What a bargain.
Yeah, right. So, I mean, you could tell me some things about, you know, international travel. And as a musician first, I have to say that that has been probably one regret I've had, is that I traveled around the country playing music, you know, solely, but I always feel that that's something I missed out on, you know, being a young person and with few responsibilities and traveling and playing music and learning all I could learn and not feeling guilty about it, just being out there, you know?
Yeah, I definitely get that. But there's a huge thing to be said for this music world, and especially for people of color in the arts. And I know this is going to get a little niche, but there are very few of us who execute on the discipline to educate ourselves and to commit to academia in the way that you have. So we might be out here doing all this stuff on the road and things like that, but we're not able to correctly or appropriately chronicle or archive our adventures, our impact, our influence. That all comes from the sort of work that you've spent a lot of time investing in. So I appreciate it.
Sure. And you know, you prepare for that by doing the opposite of traveling. You sit your butt down in a library and you just have at it for, you know, years and years, and you read mountains of materials and, you know, usually with a question in mind or something that you're trying to understand. And then you just keep going and going until you have sufficiently answered a question. And then you write a narrative of it, because you want to share what you learned.
So when did traveling become kind of a part of your life? Because even though you mentioned you've been abroad, I want to talk about that. You've traveled throughout the country. There's still a lot of people of color who don't travel even domestically. So you have to have an interest in it, especially when you have, you know, this responsibility, this thing you want to do in the library. What were your first exposures or experiences to travel, and what made you maintain that experience throughout your life?
Well, I think my first domestic travel was, having been born in Chicago, was going to my mother's home state of Georgia. I had to be about 5 or 6 years old. But then next, my first international travel was to Montreal. And now that I think about it, it was because I was in a high school choir and we traveled, you know, so maybe I did start touring early. But yeah, so, you know, we're a high quality music group that rehearsed every day at the same time, as I remember. And, you know, it had a history of the high school I went to. Thornton Township High School had a history of producing professional musicians and quality groups. And so I got to leave the country, I think, of 16.
Really?
Yeah. It was,
that's the same age I left to go to Canada, 16, my first international trip. That's wild.
Wow. Yeah. So that was a thing for me. And, you know, I think the first yearning I had for international travel had to be in sixth grade, though, because I had a sixth grade teacher who made sure that we were thinking outside the box. You know, we were from a working poor neighborhood and a working class to working poor neighborhood on the far south side of Chicago. And he was a young man who was, I think, in law school at the time. And he was a Jewish man who got a deferment from the Vietnam War to teach in what they called underserved communities or something like that, or underprivileged, or they had some kind of name for it.
Right.
He seemed to be set on making sure that we knew what was outside of the box we were in. And so, yeah, that's the first time I actually thought about international travel. And then having gotten to do it at 16, I guess that started the ball rolling.
Yeah. And already in those few experiences that you shared right there, there's so much to dive into. So first, I want to ask about your family, because you said your mom's hometown was in Georgia. So I'm guessing she was a part of the Great Migration.
She indeed was. She came to Chicago in 1949, following her mother, who had migrated to Chicago because she had a brother there.
Wow.
Her marriage was breaking up, and she decided to move there. And then her children, my mother included, follow her up there as young adults.
Wow. One, that's a huge moment in history that your folks were part of. That's really wild. What was their view on travel? Did they ever encourage you to explore besides going to see the homestead in Georgia? Did they say anything about it at all?
Not really. Not that I recall. But the one thing I can say about that generation of people, mm-hmm. who, of course, were decidedly and strategically underserved in their educations because of Jim Crow segregation.
Yeah.
I would say one of the qualities that I can say that they had is that they never told us what we could not do.
Really?
Right. I don't remember ever being told no about any aspiration or thought I had. You know, they expected us to follow through on what we wanted to do. They may not have had the resources to help in a way that they wanted to, but they certainly didn't tell us that that's not for you.
Wow. Do you think that's a trait of just your family or just that generation? Because if I thought about it at the top of my head, that sounds unusual.
I kind of think it's more the rule than the exception, you know, because if you think about it, these people were in their 30s and 40s when the civil rights generation was coming of age. Mm-hmm. If you were a man, you probably served in World War II.
Right.
And then by the time you are, you know, building your family and deep into parenthood, you're at the cusp of the civil rights movement. And those people really turned the world around with making people understand that equality was the way to go.
Right. And they also came back with a lot of worldly knowledge and experience. That World War II generation that had seen themselves differently overseas came back with a whole different perception on what the reality or the options were, the potential for us in the U.S.
Absolutely. In fact, that whole idea of Black soldiers returning to the United States after they had served overseas in a segregated army, by the way.
Right.
They had developed this idea of double V. That's victory abroad and victory at home. Mm. They began to see that if they could fight for democracy abroad, that they had every right to demand it and expect it in America.
Yeah. I'm reflecting on that a bit because it seems like there was a shift. And I know this is kind of travel adjacent, but it seems like there's a shift from that narrative that came from your folks' generation of, you know, I might not be able to support you, but I'm not going to tell you what you can't do, to these soldiers and that community movement building for civil rights in the 60s. And then it feels like there was a shift where suddenly, especially parents of color were telling their kids, okay, you can't do something. Is that a misperception of history?
You'd have to, you know, kind of expound on that a little bit. Say, are you talking about in the 70s and 80s?
Yeah, which was still before my time. Yeah, 70s, 80s. It seems there was a shift. It seems, you know, even now, you know, they talk a lot about the millennials, my generation, and how we're very, almost kind of like the hippies, that 60 and 70 generation, very trying to find our roots, trying to get in touch with culture, African culture, all that sort of stuff, that that wasn't necessarily happening as much as publicly between, you know, the 20-aughts, 90s, and the 60s, 70s.
If there is a pattern, I would say that it was, okay, so you would think about mine and your father's parents who were, you know, fighting the good fight for civil rights. Mm-hmm. And then we come along and we get the benefits of that struggle. And then our kids grow up with pretty much no firsthand knowledge of that. And mm-hmm. there's no reason for us to expect you to carry those burdens or trepidations or, you know, any sense of doubt that you should be able to demand everything, including the right to be free to make your own choices and to build your life as you see fit.
Hmm. Okay. I knew you were the man to ask these questions about, because I'd be thinking about these things and, you know, my scope, our perceptions are sometimes warped just because we feel like we have so much access to information, but not all information is great information.
Yeah. Yeah. That's why it's important to interview people, because it's not like I walk around thinking about that particular thing all the time. But if you ask me, you know, then it forces me to connect the dots.
I'm with it. Let's connect these dots together. I want to ask about your teacher in sixth grade. So I'm guessing he was white. You said he was Jewish.
Yes.
How was he able to connect these ideas to your community that you already said was underprivileged, underserved? How was he able to bring travel and the world at large to light to you as a 11, 12 year old?
First of all, I want to let's talk about, you know, this idea of being underprivileged. This is how we were described, but mm-hmm. I would probably say strategically underprivileged.
Talk to me about this, though, because that's a new concept. That's a new phrase for me. Strategically underprivileged, kind of like how I might underdeclare my earnings on my taxes. Or what are we talking about?
Oh, God, you're just like your father. I would say that when you say underprivileged, it sounds like, or when I say it, or when it's been said about a community, it seems as if that is a quality or characteristics that is innate to the group and not something that the larger society has deployed strategies to make sure that that was the case.
Okay.
Yeah. So it's just a, you know, mincing words here, but.
No, nuance is important. That's why podcasts exist, because your social media feed can't do nuance. We know that.
Yeah, yeah. And back to Mr. Malamed, which his name was Mr. Mitch Malamed. He, I believed that we had the right to have access to a broader systems of knowledge. Mm-hmm. You know, he wasn't the only one. There were, of course, African-American teachers and young people like him in their early 20s who were idealistic and believed that we had everything in us to achieve whatever we wanted to. I'm still in touch with one of them. Her name is Claire Boyce. She was a recreations teacher at first, and then she became my seventh grade teacher. And then she moved to high school when I moved to high school. And I'm still in touch with her. And wow. Mitch Malamed and I correspond. Yeah, it was a moment. It was indeed a very idealistic moment in the late 60s where people believed that they could make a change.
A pivotal one for you at the least and those in your class. What sort of ideas did he talk about that kind of piqued your curiosity? I find sometimes when an idea is new or maybe not popular, people say, forget about it. Like, there's no chance I can do it. But only a few years later, you were on your first international trip. So were you dreaming of, you know, cities he talked about, countries? What was that like for you?
That was very interesting that you asked that, because I think that there were two moves that he made that got me to think about myself, about my community, and about the world differently. The first thing is that we read the newspaper every day.
Okay.
And again, that was a highly charged political moment. We had just come out of a decade where three major leaders were assassinated: Martin Luther King, Robert Kennedy, and John Kennedy. And the Democratic National Convention, the storied Democratic National Convention from in the 1968, I think it was, had just occurred. Cities were burning. There was lots of civil unrest, and people were really breaking free from the systems of inequality that were stubbornly holding us down. And he made sure that we engage those ideas on the daily.
Hmm.
So that kind of awakened my political consciousness in a way that I wasn't necessarily being educated at home in that way. You know, first of all, you know, you have parents who are trying to survive and to feed you and house you.
Right.
And in some ways, I kind of feel that shielding us from certain things was a part of the plan.
Hmm.
But coming at it dispassionately as an intellectual endeavor, as Mish Malamud did, it kind of opened me up in a way. And I definitely remember at 12 years old being politically awakened and actually thinking about systems of inequality.
What does that discussion look like, though? Because I think you mentioned a really good point, and I'm really glad we're talking about this, that avoidance might be potentially a strategy. No disrespect to anyone, but I feel like I've seen that in my experience. So how was he able to open up these layered and complex discussions and present them in a way where you could engage and feel a part of it?
Well, it was A, happening around you.
Okay.
You know, you're witnessing buildings burning.
Touche.
Yeah.
Strong evidence.
Yeah. And then we did it in the context of social studies. So for him, social studies did not just mean historical events. You know, it meant what was going on in the contemporary moment mm-hmm. that had everything to do with societal shifts.
Yeah.
Yeah. So he really laid that on us. I can't really say how many of us were changed in that way. I wasn't aware of. There may have been two or three or four people that I remember having these conversations with in sixth grade. And I also can't speak in firsthand about what other kids were hearing from their parents. You know, maybe they were being politically informed at home.
Right.
Yeah. It would talk about certain things, you know, in a certain way. And then the second piece that happened is that I remember distinctly having a social studies assignment where I had to study Belgium.
I
had never thought about Belgium before. And
right.
I did my little research and I think I created a Belgium cafe.
No way.
Yeah. I think that's where I took it. And, I remember the assignment. I remember something about a Belgian cafe. But I would say those two things combined helped me become, you know, more expansive in my worldview beyond my neighborhood.
I love that because not only is it a very approachable history, but it shows how these small things can go such a long way. It's just an idea planted in your mind, but it opens up all of these pathways to potential. That's the coolest thing. And this is very you. I see the Belgian cafe right now. Because I kind of think of the early 20s in Paris with the cafe culture and the absinthe and, you know, sitting outside and just talking as intellectuals do. This seems very Mr. Ramsey. It seems on brand.
Yeah, I guess I got turned out, you know.
That was it. Listen, that's all it takes. Did this provide some more momentum for your first international trip? And I know I definitely want to talk about these later trips, but was there anything about that first international trip with the choir that also encouraged you or kind of set more bait for you to keep chasing these experiences?
Well, you know what? I didn't really connect the dots between, you know, studying Belgium and going to school in Montreal. I'm in the context of this conversation, I'm doing that. But at that right. time, I was part of the group and the group was going and somehow my parents got the money together and I was able to go there. If anything, I met a young girl my age on that trip and she was from Montreal, you know, so young, you know, black sister who was bilingual and she had this French accent and all of that. And I just remember falling completely in love in a day.
Happens to the best of us. Only the best of us happens to the best.
Yeah, then I think, you know, did we stay in touch? No, what's her name? I can't remember, but I remember if anything inspired that idea of adventure and travel and just being around something new, you know, it could have been that. Just the idea of a bilingual, you know, black girl, you know, who was cute in Montreal. And I'm sure that that got me all, you know, feeling that, hey, this traveling is for me, you know.
They got girls like this out here.
Yeah, right.
Exactly. Passport time.
Yeah, so it was, I just remember having a blast. I just remember being really thrilled to be out of the country and to be somewhere that I just read about.
Yeah, there's that discovery part. That's why I consider my stuff more like adventures rather than trips or vacations. One, it's very difficult for me to take a vacation, but I'll take an adventure. I will definitely take an adventure.
right.
I mentioned something as a joke. I said the word passport, and I thought to ask you, in your time growing up, do you remember it being particularly difficult for people of color to get access to passports? Do you remember passports ever being a part of the discussion for you?
No, I don't remember that at all. Okay. I'm pretty sure that it didn't occur.
Okay.
I can't remember if my mother has been out of the country or not. She's 93. And I know my father only traveled as a result of being a young soldier. Hmm. In the army during World War II.
Right. That's super real. I'm going to want to keep bringing up these moments because I think it's really important for myself to get a deeper understanding, but also everyone listening, that the context drove a lot of people's, just like our context today drives our decisions, our ability to do something like a podcast. But it's fascinating to me to have the opportunity to ask you a few questions about, okay, like what was going on? Because sometimes we lose track of context. We're like, oh, I'd never do that if it was my day. I'm like, hold up a second, Chief. Like, context matters.
Yes.
And so moving forward, as you continue to travel, because again, being a musician and traveling throughout the US is no easy job. What were you gaining from those experiences besides growing as a musician and maybe the chance to meet another bilingual Canadian?
Well, or a farm girl from South Dakota, or, you know, I learned that as we moved around the country with this band, it was like it was a hotel band.
OK,
so what we did, it was a circuit of hotels that got their nightly entertainment from some kind of network. Mm hmm. That book gigs 2 weeks at a time, you know, in various cities around the country. And I was part of two of those things. One, I think I was 18 or 19 years old, mm-hmm. because I did not go to college straight away. I went on the road with bands. We had a residency in New Orleans for a summer. That was really great.
I can only imagine. My goodness.
Yeah, it was just fantastic. And then the other one was kind of a Midwestern thing when we were traveling, you know, west from Illinois and as far as North Dakota and Montana. Yeah, so that was a whole other swing that taught me a lot about being around, you know, some Native Americans who would come to the hotel, you know, bars to get their entertainment, their live entertainment.
Wow.
And so it was interesting just meeting a lot of different people who did not grow up as I did. It was a learning experience for me as a young person.
What was maybe one of the more surprising things that you learned during these years?
Well, I learned that I love music, but I also began to think that if I was not going to pack up and move to New York with nothing but a practice habit, and a dream that I better go, you know, get a college degree. So that's what I learned.
How did that moment of discovery come about? Can you dive more into it? And this might be getting more specific for artists, but I think that's a really interesting observation, a really strong moment of honesty.
Well, I thought that although there's a sense of adventure moving from city to city, but it's also very hard. It's hard because you don't have a social life beyond the band that you are with and the guests who come through to see you play. And you're not going to form strong bonds with the guest because in 2 weeks you're going to be leaving for the next city.
Right.
You know, it's just was the lifestyle. I did a lot of stuff to keep it interesting, I became a jogger, you know, and I became a vegetarian, you know, just to stay in my health thing. And then I actually practiced a lot during the day to, you know, try to get my chops together. But that's the extent of life, basically.
Right.
I was a curious person who wanted more. I knew that that wasn't going to be the end for me.
Yeah, that's real. I definitely get it. That's part of the reason I left the country in the first place. Curiosity. Mm. We'll put it on curiosity. Mm-hmm. But also that sense of there's got to be more than this. I think sometimes we get to a place where it's like, okay, yeah, this is cool for now, but what's next? What's on the horizon? Is anybody doing something that I feel like I'd actually want to do? Yeah, that's a really interesting realization. I think it's important. I think more people could use those.
Yeah, they definitely could. And then they have to have the courage to make a change and the curiosity, as you say, to explore different things. And then also what's important is to have some kind of support, even if it's not financial, it has to be moral support where you're still being encouraged by the people who, you know, who love you and who you love to just take those steps to do more self-discovery.
That's a huge point. A community, maybe even a source of accountability. My goodness, accountability has been driving my world for the past 6 weeks since we've been sheltered in place. So I definitely get that. I think there are more opportunities than ever to explore those options, but I feel like people don't hear it enough that, hey, this is kind of important. You can't just do everything on your own.
Exactly. Exactly.
So you do college in reverse, which I'm just going to say it that way. You're like, y'all graduating, I'm a sign up. That's okay. I might do that again one day. I think it's dope.
Hey, okay, I'll start using that too. I like it.
Wait till my first book comes out. It'll be called Retirement in Reverse because that is my life right now.
let me add this too. Now that I'm talking to you, I actually did move to California a year after high school.
Really?
Yes. And, you know, I had some friends who were moving out there, and I moved out there for a year and lived a California life, let's say, made friends. And then I came back from there, back to Chicago, regrouped, and then I went on the road. And then I left New Orleans and went to Northeastern Illinois University. And that's, you know, at age 21 or 22 or something like that. And that's how it worked for me. Yes.
So you had already gone through a couple of transitions, scenes from different cities, having to build that skill of making new social circles. You had already been building some of this up in practice.
Absolutely. And thanks for helping me to remember that, because I've never been afraid to change.
Mm. That'll probably be the title of the show, just in case anybody's wondering. Just going to leave that space right there. I do want to ask you something, though, before we talk about more of your adventures and conquests and how your career has developed. You were able to make all these moves, get this sort of exposure. And when I say all, I don't want to say it's a lot, but they were significant moves. You challenged yourself to move in some different cities and different areas across the country. You took this trip to go to Canada. You were inspired. Did you find that a lot of your contemporaries from back home were doing the same thing?
Some were, some weren't.
Okay.
Some took more traditional routes. There was, and that's the interesting thing about this, let's call it the post-industrial moment, that moment in the mid-70s where all of the industrial jobs that drew all of these Southerners to the North began to shift to technology jobs. And this shift really left them in the wake.
Yeah.
Those of us who were, you know, young and graduating high school at that time, we had the world ahead of us. And what I noticed around my quote unquote underserved, underprivileged area is that you had just as many people make it as not make it. You had on the block that I grew up, you know, one house would produce a professor. The next house would have a high school dropout. Another house would produce a pharmacist. The next house, you know what I mean? It was a really mixed bag.
Yeah.
that's what I experienced. So there were people who got certain messages and certain people who maybe didn't have the support or the mindset or made a bad decision or whatever. But it was, I don't want to say luck of the draw, because if you made it, you had to work for it. But it's not as if we who made it look down on those who did not. That wasn't the scene. It's just that it happened that way for some people.
For sure. I think that would be, I think in any case, that would be a weird thing to say. That's not the sort of person I know you as. Mm-hmm. Not even in jest.
Mm-hmm.
But I was curious to ask, because I find even today when I interview all these different men that they notice that a lot of people from their communities aren't leaving, and there's an idea of safety, there's security in what is familiar. And I was curious if that, again, if this is something that some of our communities have seen to different degrees over time. So I was curious to your answer to that.
Well, I wasn't as aware of it at the time. I got my high school diploma at age 17. By the time I was 18, I had moved in an apartment with some buddies, you know, musicians, of course.
Right.
And got me a part-time job, you know, which you could do at that time, was easier. You know, we had it easier than your generation of people to try to establish things. You know, it was just easier time. So don't let anybody tell you that things aren't working out because it's, you know, because your generation is lazier. It has nothing to do with that. It has everything to do with how society was structured then.
Mm.
Yeah. So I left as soon as it was legally okay for me to do so.
Right.
So I don't compare myself to anybody like that, because I've always just been ready to, you know, move on. You know, if I were to look at my own children, I noticed that many of their high school peers did not go further than 30 miles away from home to go to school, to go to college.
Right.
The vast majority of them, I think maybe three or four from one class, decided to go away, you know, to go, you know, out of state to try new things. So maybe it's a little more common for people to stick around, you know?
Yeah, maybe it is. I think I grew up in a situation where, similar to yours, where I was kind of always going to do my own thing, but I've been that way for a while. So I'm always curious to see if I can dial in these elements a little bit more, because everyone, you know, to each their own. Your lifestyle is your lifestyle. I'm able to adventure and travel. You're able to adventure and travel because people are committed to being teachers and running power plants. Like, I like the power to work when I show up in your country. But I also think there are opportunities to explore yourself more when you do move, at least out of, you know, experience something outside of the town you grew up in.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, some of us crave that, you know.
And some of us get lost in that loop, like you were talking about, moving from hotel twice a month to hotel, and you get stuck in that loop. You know, we're always, it's almost like avoidance trying to run away.
Yes, yes.
There's a spectrum. This show is about the spectrum.
Yeah.
So let's fast forward a bit to your international travels with your career and with the band that accompanies you. Where were some places you've explored? I know you went to South Africa, if you wanted to mention some things there, but I wanted to know, what did you gain from these international experiences? I found that international travel has really shaped my mindset. Like, what were you able to take from those experiences and bring back to the classroom or to your writings or even to your music?
Well, one of the things I notice is the ubiquity and the dominance of African-American music around the world. No matter where I've gone, whether it's taking my band to Uruguay in South America or playing some of my compositions in Italy when I was there, going to South Africa and playing and lecturing. African-American music is really respected and thought highly of around the world.
Did that surprise you? Like, what was the moment where you first realized, like, wait a second, it's for real? Because I'm sure you had read about it or at least seen some papers or something, you know, saying the same thing. Did it take you a moment of experiencing it to really be convinced?
It's something that I hadn't really thought about. And I had thought about it and read about it in the abstract. But when you go to, say, Paris, or, you know, you go to France, you go to Italy, you go to South America, you go to South Africa,
you go to London, and you hear African-American artists on the radio in regular rotation, and people know it. Mm-hmm. When I spent some time in Giverny outside of Paris, my wife and I were in this village, and we saw a band playing all of this, you know, Southern gospel rock music like Sweet Home Alabama. Mm. And they know the music. They know all the nuances of it. They can sing in English, but they don't really have a command of the English language outside of that context.
Right, right.
You know, and you just say, wow, this is really, you know, important music. And it absolutely made me proud. Now, some of it travels in the pop machine, you know what I mean? So if you hear a John Legend song, it's because it's part of this American pop dominance that is a very dependable export, let's call it. Mm-hmm. But then, you know, you'll hear, you know, jazz and hear a lot of stuff that's pretty specialized, I think. You're just more aware of it, it seems, you know. If you're listening to French radio, I remember listening to French radio, and that was the year that song, We Come Too Far.
Get Lucky by Pharrell. Or no, Daft Punk with Pharrell producing it.
Yeah, we're up all night to get lucky. You know, so this was the only English song that came on, you know, about 10 times a day.
Right.
So it just made me see American music in another context. Another thing I saw was that people are consuming American music under that guise, and they're mixing genres a lot more than you would hear on radio formats or restaurant formats in the States, you know? Right. So, you know, I've just made observations and ones that one can only make if you're traveling.
So in all your travels and experience, have you ever had a moment in your international travels that shifted your perspective of yourself or of culture? Like really changed how you saw things?
Just off the top of my head, one of the things that I've been disappointed in myself is that, you know, I can manage to get around Spanish-speaking countries. Just as a musicologist, you learn to read German, French. I learned to read some Italian and learned to read Spanish.
Oh, what's a musicologist, Mr. Ramsey?
A music historian.
Ah, okay.
The person who studies the science of music, the history of music, the grammar of music, the social impact of music.
Beautiful. I didn't know that. Thank you.
Yeah. It's a kind of a Germanic field, a field that began in Germany in the sense that we teach it today. And so I have passive knowledge of languages, you know, including French, where in my heyday, when I was studying all those things, I could actually read around all those languages.
Wow.
But, you know, one of the best ways to, you know, as you know, is to get in there and speak the language and learn the language, learn how to communicate with people. So much living happens in language.
Absolutely. So you started off saying that you find you get by pretty well in the Spanish-speaking countries, and the other ones you struggle a little bit more?
Yeah, I remember because, okay, this was back in the late 80s, early 90s when I was learning to read all these languages. And the more you don't use them, the more I think you lose a verb a day. So, or something like that. So it's just like I'm weaker than I was when I was really learning them. And, you know, you miss trains, you miss, you know, because you're not facile with the language. And that's very disappointing to me to not be able to get around places, you know, more. You get around more easily if you know the language. And I've been disappointed that I haven't traveled enough to put that pressure on myself to learn.
Mm, I got you. I see where you're coming from now. Well, mm-hmm. I support you in this journey.
Yeah, man. So because you speak French, right?
Yes.
Yeah, I think that's awesome, man. It's the way to go. It's the way to go. You get to experience a place a lot better when you are exchanging ideas through language.
Right, right. And I think the intention has to be there as well. I support everybody wherever they are with their language journey, their travel journey. It depends on your intention, but it definitely helps to get access because language is a part of culture and you become kind of like an insider. You get to you just have more depth of experience, potentially.
Yes, yes, indeed, indeed.
Speaking of international travel and needing to get around, how have you seen travel evolve since you started going out regularly with, not regularly, but with your band? How have you seen things evolve maybe over the past, I don't know, how long have you been traveling with your group?
Maybe since 2003.
Okay, cool. I didn't want to like put extra numbers in there for you, but how have you seen things change or shift in the past, you know, since 2003? How has travel opened up or made things easier or more difficult?
Well, in the context of dragging a band with me, people are a lot more open to it than they used to be, you know? And that, I think that has something to do with the fact that I've been insisting long enough, and then your career gets to have a certain gravitas, and, you know, people are less likely to reject that model. You know, they want you up there with a chalkboard and a pointer and a lectern, you know. But that's kind of changed where people are a lot more open. And in fact, I just got a nice invitation the other day to do exactly what was subversive back when I was starting to do it. People are now asking me, this is what we want. Can you bring that particular model to the university?
Abroad or in the States?
In the States. Let me see if I have gotten an invitation to go abroad and do this. I have to think about it. I don't think so.
It brings up another question. What have you been using as your defense or argument to vouch for yourself being able to go abroad and share your knowledge in this specific format? Because it sounds like there's been some kickback, some resistance. How are you able to push through that?
Just being stubborn. And
it is Taurus season.
Yeah. But just insisting on the model that I felt made me feel whole and complete, because what I saw is that everybody is being themselves. And just because I'm who I am doesn't mean that I don't deserve to have as much freedom to do it the way I want to do. Yeah, because when I first started graduate school as a musicologist, you had to almost prove that you had left behind that long and emotional investment you had in yourself as a musician, because you were trying to be a scholar. Yeah. And that's kind of changed now.
That's really interesting. It's not wholly surprising, but what made you stick through with it?
Because I felt like it was just, it was right. It was, you know, I wasn't trying to be like anybody else. And you kind of get that. I mean, you can go one of two ways. I'm the first African-American to get a musicology degree from the University of Michigan.
Wow.
I am the first Black person to be a musicologist at Tufts University and at the University of Pennsylvania. I don't talk about that much, but it's been a journey.
Yeah.
And I learned early on that there's no way that I can be someone else, and that I had to move with my own ideas of how things should work. And I started writing about it in that way. I started, you know, putting my activism in both my scholarship and my music. You know, I wasn't the only one doing that, but it's a lot better now. It's accepted more.
I definitely see that. So in some ways, your trips abroad are more than you just sharing your knowledge or being seen as an expert in your field. They're really extensions of your authentic expression.
And I believe it has to be. You're absolutely right. I learned long ago that I couldn't even write articles if I was sitting there lying to the page.
Yeah, that brings a whole different angle into it. Sometimes we see the activity or the behavior, but we don't understand really where that's drawing energy from. And it's from you being you in this academic environment, which has its rules. Like academia, listen, I won't even look at a college application. So all the respect in the world to you, sir. But that brings a lot different context to you being invited to South Africa. You in Cape Town?
I was in Bloemfontein to give the lecture, but I traveled to Durban, Johannesburg, and Cape Town as well.
It's more than just the trip. It's more than the miles. This is you being yourself.
Right. And trying to believe in that. And actually, feeling uncomfortable at first when an early part of my career trying to figure it out, and then settling in on this idea that you better be yourself because you don't want to look back and have created this totally inauthentic presence in the field that has nothing to do with who you are and what you want the world to be, to this point now where people are asking for that. And not only that, since I've been in the field long enough, there are people that I've taught and people who have, you know, both in my classrooms and through my writing, who have emulated this model.
Right.
So it's, yeah, it's all good.
So you're actually blazing trails for others in their lifetime.
This is what they tell me.
I like it. I like it. I'm no mystic, but I'm a good guesser. I think that that's pretty accurate.
Hey, man, you know, they might be lying. I don't know.
Well, I do want to ask you more about your trip to South Africa. Was that your first time on the continent?
Yes.
Can you talk to me about, just share with me some of that experience? You've seen more of the country than I have. I've spent 2 weeks in Johannesburg, but you've seen Durban, you've seen Cape Town. These are some of the largest hot spots in the country. How did you feel?
I was so grateful to be able to make that trip and grateful to be asked by this Music Scholars Association there, the South African, I forget the name of them, but it's the big group of scholars there. And I was totally outdone and to be asked, and I loved learning about how smart and cosmopolitan the Black South Africans are.
Yeah.
How many languages they knew and how much about the political situation they understood about the United States. It made me understand different systems of oppression where they are moving from apartheid to some form of democracy. And it made me understand that America in many ways wants to have a tiered citizenship and moving to something else. I don't understand, you know, quite what we're trying to do right now as a country. But it just helped me understand and to compare different systems of oppression. I also learned about the different cultures in the cities, like Johannesburg reminded me of New York. Durban reminded me of Chicago in some ways, and Cape Town reminded me of San Francisco, you know, both geographically and in spirit, you know, in some ways. And Bloemfontein reminded me of, I really had never seen anything like that. It was kind of really remote, you know, kind of situation. Yeah, but I will say this, that the most exciting aspect of my trip there happened when I saw the Indian Ocean. It's someplace I never thought I'd see. And it's someplace that I had looked at maps throughout my life and I've seen it. But to actually see the Indian Ocean filled me with a sense of awe and gratitude.
Yeah. Yeah, I definitely feel that. It's kind of a moment when you, it's not like it was necessarily on your list, like you have a checklist for life, but it kind of is where two puzzle pieces complete each other and it just feels solid.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
Ah, okay. Yeah, this is it. Like I've done it.
Yeah, definitely. And the food in Durban, I really love that because of the Indian influence.
Yeah.
And also one of the things that really surprised me was the slave trade that occurred in the cuffs between, you know, the eastern shore of Africa and India and Indonesia. So that whole system of slavery was one that I had never considered. I just thought about the Atlantic slave trade, but the Indian Ocean slave trade is just as important. That really floored me.
And you see a lot of the impacts of it when you see Reunion Island or Mauritius or Madagascar. It's all in the coasts.
Yeah, there's so much more to learn, obviously. I was only there for, oh man, maybe a couple of weeks.
Which is a fair amount of time to see some things. I'm thinking like, man, most Americans don't have 2 weeks of vacation, but I'm with you on this one. I'm with you on this one.
Yeah.
I think it's really interesting that you being someone who's been, I'll say, socially conscious from such an early age and being in the world of academia and committing so much to the study of Blacks in music and history, that there were some things that you gained new perspective from once you actually step on the soil abroad. It changes things.
Yes, it does. What people are talking about, how they talk about it, I saw some classrooms with little Muslim girls in them in Cape Town, and I got to hear how they were instilling pride and efficacy in those girls. I just thought it was great.
And even from the, you know, the way society is created and the things we have outlined, who we support, who we don't support, having that viewpoint, I think changes things as well. Did you have those discussions with anybody about, you know, trying to explain that not everybody here is Barack Obama or Beyonce?
I didn't really have that experience. I thought they were educating me about a lot of things.
Okay.
Yeah, that's the experience I had. You know, I was doing a lot of listening.
Okay. I get a little bit in my experiences, I've had a little bit of both, but I've been talking to much, much younger kids. I'll say, yeah, normally kids. But it sounds like you might've been in an area where there was just a lot to explore. Did you go to the Orbit in Johannesburg?
No.
The Orbit Jazz Club. I think that's what it's called.
I did hear some music though. I did play with some musicians over there in the hotel I was staying in Johannesburg had a really, really nice band in the lobby. And I got to sit in and play with them and befriended the bass player on Facebook. And we actually corresponded for a little bit.
See, y'all, you always need a great bass player, no matter who you are. This is why Jerry still leaves the country. You just need one.
Hey, man. You guys are much needed.
Essential. Well, Mr. Ramsey, I definitely appreciate hearing about your experiences, and thanks for your patience in allowing me to pause and focus a little bit more on these more historical moments, because I think context helps breed productive nuance when it comes to discussion. So thank you so much.
Oh, thank you for the time. You know, I discovered a few things about myself, you know, just how you were framing the questions and what you were focusing on. I don't really think about myself in that way. I'm usually thinking about my work.
I understand that's what helps the machine keep going, but this is a platform all about you. And I hope you haven't forgotten these things about yourself, because this is the part of the show where you tell us all the upcoming awesome projects for you, things you're involved in, where people can locate you. So if you will, please, sir, grace the stage one last time for us.
Well, I have a new music project about to come out. It's called A Spiritual Vibe, and it is a project that's near and dear to my heart because it's comprises music that I meditated on when I was healing from a cancer diagnosis last year. 2 days before my surgery, I booked some time in the studio and invited a lot of musicians over and family, friends, and I cut some tracks. And then I spent the next year thinking about those tracks, and then I'm just finishing them up. And so A Spiritual Vibe will drop this month. I have a clean bill of health, so I think the music worked.
Yeah.
So I want to share that healing with everybody. And,
wow.
Yeah. So my Facebook is Musicology. Facebook page is Musicology, Musicology. And Instagram is Ramsey Music.
You on the Instagrams?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
What? Let me find out. My network isn't complete.
You're funny. Yeah, so I got that. And then I'm also writing a book called Soundproof, Black Music, Magic, and Racial Intimacies. It's my take on the history of African-American music from the slave era to the present.
Wow.
Yeah. And so those are the two big projects. I got other stuff happening too, but I don't want anybody to fall asleep if they haven't already.
No, people like to listen just for these parts. And you also have some other published works out as well too, right?
Yes. My first book is called Race Music, Black Cultures from Bebop to Hip Hop. And I have another book on the jazz pianist Bud Powell called The Amazing Bud Powell, Black Music Genius. What is the subtitle? But it's called The Amazing Bud Powell.
I love it.
Black Genius, Jazz History, and the Challenge of Bebop. That's the subtitle. And then I have a book I edited and wrote a foreword for about to come out in July. It's my mentor, Ray Linda Brown, wrote a brilliant book on the Black woman composer, Florence Price. And unfortunately, she passed away a couple years ago before the book could be published. And I edited it and wrote a foreword to contextualize the book. And the University of Illinois Press is publishing that book this July. So that's the next thing that's coming out.
Nice. Some potentially awesome reads if you are sheltering in place and being safe. You can find all these on Amazon, too, the ones that are out currently, right?
Of course.
Oh, yeah. We got that delivery. Stay safe at home, y'all. One thing I do want to mention, because there's no way you're not going to talk a little bit about this. You were just recently elected to the American Academy of Arts and Sciences, correct?
Yes, sir.
Congratulations. Can you share what that means a little bit? What comes with it? Do you get a hat? Do you get a ribbon? A key to the city?
I don't know yet. Maybe lunch.
Bagel and lox?
Yeah, something like that. The Academy was founded in 1780, and it honors excellence and leaders from every field of human endeavor, new ideas and issues of importance to the nation. And it's about serving the public good, and it's an honorary society, and it's a pretty big deal, and I'm very honored to be inducted this fall.
Well, we're honored to have you on here sharing your story, sharing your perspective. I'm grateful to know you. Like, thank you so, so much. And last question, because I'm going to have to keep putting you on the spot. I wanted to know, with all your experience, all that you've seen, all that you've witnessed and recorded, what do you think is the number one reason why men of color should pursue travel?
The same reason everybody should, because it expands your horizons. It gives you an idea about the world, and it gives you even better ideas about yourself.
Love it. Point blank, full stop.
Yes, sir.
Well, appreciate the time, Mr. Ramsey. Hope to have you back here on the platform. Maybe we'll do some sort of live panel on the East Coast or something like that. Definitely going to be one of my favorite sessions. So hope to have you back on the platform soon, and you take care out there.
Thank you, J3. Appreciate you, man.
Mr. Ramsey is that guy. Thank you so much for spending the time to share just a slice of your time with me and all the listeners out here. Mr. Ramsey, thank you so much. Y'all make sure you check him out on IG at Ramsey Music. Make sure you keep an eye out for Soundproof and also his new project, A Spiritual Vibe. All these things sound amazing, and I think I've already found my next bit of quarantine or shelter in place reading, as it were. Seriously, thank you so much, Mr. Ramsey. It was just an honor to speak with you. And while I was editing the show, y'all, I gotta be super transparent here. I was like, damn, I've actually been like out of my lane. This dude is popping, like famous. That was like my Barack Obama of the podcast right now. So as an untrained journalist, that's no excuse. I do my best to be appropriate, to be respectful, and bring y'all some cool and compelling content that'll encourage you to make similar shifts that he's made throughout his life. I love the part where he said he's never been afraid to change, and especially with so much going on right now, so much uncertainty, I feel like changes are coming in the form of opportunities. Opportunities often mean changes, so keep that in mind. But this is for sure one of my favorite sessions. So again, until next time, I hope you all are taking care of each other, taking care of yourselves first and foremost. And one thing that I do want to mention is that we are currently temporarily suspending our passport sponsorship. Why? Because the U.S. Department of State says it will take months to get your stuff back. So unless there's a life or death emergency that demands your attention abroad, chances are it's not happening anytime soon. So we want to make sure that we are still setting up these men for success, not out into a world that is maybe unready for people to be traveling in mass right now. So we're going to take our time. We're going to pay attention to the officials and the experts. And when it is safe to resume that part of our mission with the show, we will. So until then, look out for any more information. We'll be sure to provide you with it. That all being said, we will be back in 2 weeks with another fantastic story from another fantastic man of color and his perspective. So can't wait until you join us then. If you have a couple moments, leave us a review on iTunes. You know, we're still schmoozing for these iTunes reviews. Hit us up, leave us a review, let people know what you think about the show, and we'll definitely shout it out next time. Until then, this is Jerry III, aka Kimono Jack. signing off. Take care.